Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast.
Hi, Laura. Nice to be here.
So happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I am a full-time writer now, although I started out my professional life as a historian, as an academic. I thought I would end up being a college professor. There weren't really any jobs. There still aren't if you want to teach British history. Those jobs are thin on the ground. So I ended up being an editor for years. And then when I was at home with my kids when they were really little, I found myself wanting to do something more, something different. And it took me a long time, and I only had, a few minutes here and there for, I guess it was about a year and a bit it took me to write it, in kind of stolen moments when the kids were sleeping. And so that was coming up 14 years ago. And now I get to say, this is my gig. This is my full-time job, and it's wonderful. And I live in Toronto. I'm a Canadian, hence the funny accent. And you'll notice if I have to say the final letter in the alphabet out loud, I'm going to say Z rather than Z. That's a giveaway every time.
I love this. So did you always wanted to marry your writing process with historical fiction, or was it something that you just like?
It took me a long time to figure out that I wanted to write fiction. I'd always, as an academic, you end up having to write very dry, dull, nonfiction. And I hadn't done much of that either for years because I'd been working mostly as an editor. I'd been fixing other people's writing, but not concentrating on my own. Mm-hmm. And then when I started writing, it was always historical fiction. I've never had an interest in writing anything else for myself. Now, I read widely and I love contemporary fiction. Mm-hmm. I love sci-fi. I mean, you name it, I'll read any genre. I don't love horror. And that's not to diss it as a genre. It's just that I have one of those very, very overly sensitive kind of psyches that, if I read a horror story, the minute I fall asleep, I'm back in it. And so cue the sleep disturbances for weeks. So I can't, anything that's even mildly scary, I unfortunately can't do. But I love really most genres. But the one that I want to write in is historical fiction. And I think that's just because I'm a history nerd, and it ticks all the boxes for me. So all of the fun parts of teaching history I get to do with thing. But I get to talk about the things and write about them. And really, it's the best I can imagine.
There we go. So what was your journey to get that first book published?
It was a long journey, which is, pretty typical of most people who start out. I had a background in publishing, so I knew the route that I was supposed to take. I didn't make any of those mistakes that are easy to make because, it how do you really know until you're in that world? Mm-hmm. So I knew not to send an unsolicited manuscript off to an editor, for example. Mm-hmm. I knew that I needed to get a literary agent. But the thing is, it's really hard to get a literary agent, especially one who's the real deal too. I mean, there are plenty of people out there masquerading as literary agents who are in fact complete con artists, and you really do need to be very careful when you're sending your work to somebody with a view to them signing you as a writer. And I tried for so I finished my first book in about 2009, and I sent it out to a number of literary agents, and I basically didn't hear back from anyone. And the few people I heard back from said, well, you know, it's set in World War One. Nobody's really interested in World War One historical fiction. Thanks, but no thanks. And so I gave up for a few years because it just, you know, and I had little kids and I was busy with other stuff and it was kind of depressing. So I didn't persevere. And then it was only a couple of years later that the show that was on TV in the UK came out and everyone was talking about it. And then it came to the States on PBS. And I think you've guessed that it was Downton Abbey. Mm-hmm. And that show went just, you know, it just went big. Mm-hmm. And one of my closest friends, who knew, you know, she'd read my manuscript. She loved it. She'd been as disappointed as I was when I couldn't get it published or couldn't find an agent in the first place. She pestered me, to be honest. She just was relentless and said, you have to submit this again. Just Jen, just go for it. And so I did to a different group of literary agents. And this time it was like night and day. Pretty much everyone got back to me right away. Mm-hmm. Everyone was super enthusiastic. And it was, you know, the book itself had not changed. Mm-hmm. The market had changed. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, everyone wanted these books about the First World War and you know, the Edwardian period. And I had one that was ready to go. And because of that timing, when it was published, it was one of the first books, you know, works of historical fiction, written kind of with a female reader in mind, mm-hmm. With a heroine, First World War, that was about a woman. And it surpassed all expectations, including mine. I'd hoped I would sell like maybe mm-hmm. a few thousand copies. And it just kept selling and selling and selling. And now it's in, I think it's 19th or 20th edition. It almost actually feels like it's a story that it can't be true. and you know, here I am, you know, 10, 11 years later, and I still can't believe that it's true. But, it, you know, I pinch myself every morning. I feel so lucky to do this work.
I love this story. I love the fact that, you know, you didn't give up. The market changes, and so your book becomes a hot commodity. Like it's interesting, yeah. How, you know, little things can make a big impact. Like a TV show can become kind of like a boom of things, like, you know.
Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah. And that said, I always, when I've taught writing courses, when I speak to aspiring writers, I always want to encourage people to, all of that being true, don't chase after what you think is the hot thing. Mm-hmm. Don't kind of tailor what you're writing with the view to, well, maybe this is what will sell. I think the only judgment you can use when you're writing a book is this something that I love writing myself? I love reading about it. Is reading. Ultimately, that's how I assess every one of my books. As I'm writing it, as I'm finishing it, I ask myself, is this a book that my friends in my book club would love to read? And if I can honestly answer yes, then I think I've done an okay job. Of course, pending approval of my editor. Everything is pending her approval.
So let's talk about historical fiction. And so thinking about, you have written different time periods. What does the research process looks like for you?
You know, it doesn't really deviate from what I learned as a graduate student. I went to Oxford. I have what they call a DPhil, and in North America we call it PhD. And it's a research degree. There's no teaching involved. You just sit and you write a 100,000 word thesis over the course of however many years it takes you. And so I learned there how to dig deep. Mm-hmm. And I think of it in some ways as almost like being an archaeologist, right? And I'm peeling back the layers. Mm-hmm. And I start first with just general histories that other people have written, just to acquaint myself with the broader subject. Mm-hmm. And then I go to specialist histories. So I might read about particular groups of people. I might read about political movements. I might read about the history of a city, or the history of say just the history of fashion in a particular period if I want to learn about what people were wearing, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the whole time I'm digging, I'm trying to go deeper and deeper. And for me, the bedrock, or how should I put it, the layer that where all of the treasures are found, is anything that is what you would call formally a primary source. So a primary source is it's closest to the direct voice of the people who lived in a period, and it's the closest you can get to jumping in a time machine and going back to that particular time, especially if it's a time that's remote enough that nobody is still alive who experienced it. Mm-hmm. And that would be the case, for example, with the First World War today. Mm-hmm. And so what I want to know is what people were thinking at the time. What were their opinions? What were their thoughts? What were the things that influenced them? And so there I get a little unconventional compared to maybe your kind of stuffy old-fashioned historian, because I'm really interested in reading things like magazines, newspapers, and not newspapers, the Daily Telegraph, but news ordinary people read, right? And which are very different typically. I also am interested in what were the movies they were watching, if it's a period when, you know, cinema existed. What were the books they were reading? Again, not high-minded stuff, but ordinary books that regular people read, right? The paperbacks that everyone was reading at the time. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things, plus people's memoirs and diaries, that's where I build up a picture of what life was like in the past. And if I'm really lucky, and and since I write about the 20th century, there's almost always ways of finding taped interviews with people. Even if the interviews were done a while ago, they're still gold mines. Mm-hmm. I may not have been asking the questions, but if I'm lucky, the person who is asking the questions asked questions that provoke answers that I find, you know, that are interesting and useful to me. So the Imperial War Museum of all places in London has thousands and thousands of hours of taped recordings of interviews that were done starting in the 1960s with people who lived through the First World War and the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And there's so much there. I've really only kind of scraped the surface of their holdings, but every time I go and I listen to what they have, much of which you can access online without ever going to London, mm-hmm. there's so much there. So that's kind of my approach. And it's a little bit, it's not actually very unorthodox. I think a lot of people, that's the way they're doing their research now. When I was at Oxford in the early 1990s, it was considered a little unusual. And there's sometimes some raised eyebrows, but I think it works. I want to know what ordinary people thought, felt, were interested in, what the shape of their ordinary day was like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. I love reading historical fiction, even historical romance, because it just brings you kind of like a different period. And then you have to think of all these logistics of like, what did they wear? Like, how did they transport? Like, you know, what did they read? And so I love like finding out the authors, like, you know, down your rabbit hole. What they had to go through to inform us of that.
Oh, story. And I fall down many, many rabbit holes. It's a kind of a professional hazard of losing an entire day to learning about something that really has no bearing on the work in progress and may not be something that I ever really need to retain, but it's super interesting. and that's how my brain works, and I've learned not to fight it.
I love this. And so what was the source of inspiration for Our Darkest Night?
So for me, it was very personal. It is very personal. I'd been working on another book entirely and not really loving it. I was still chasing after that aha moment where everything starts to come together. Mm-hmm. And my son, who's now 16, so this is a couple of years ago, he came to me and said, you know, Mom, remember when we were in Italy and we were talking about what Daddy's grandparents did during the war, and I'm wondering if it's true. And what he wanted to know about was a family story that we had not learned we'd only learned it very recently. It was on a trip to Italy coming up 5 years ago when my husband and I were sitting and talking with his aunt, who still lives in this little town in northern Italy called San Zanone, where my mother-in-law and father-in-law were born. They came to Canada in the 1950s, but they grew up in Italy, and most of the family is still there. And over the course of a conversation that I only kind of partially understood, because I understand Italian, well, sort of okay. And I understand, actually, I'm more likely to understand dialect, their local dialect, than proper Italian. But I was able to make out what they're saying. And at some point in the conversation, my husband was asking his aunt, who's now in her late 80s, about what it was like growing up during the war and what her experiences were. And out of the blue, she started talking about how her father, her mother and father, but it was her father who kind of was the driving force, how they hid people in their house from the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And so we pressed a little bit, and the people they hid were Jewish. They were Italians, they were Jewish, and they had to go into hiding once the Nazi occupation began in 1943. Mm-hmm. So of course, I still remember just sitting there being absolutely flabbergasted, because I'd been part of my husband's family for almost 20 years at that point. And I thought, how is it we never talked about this? And both my mother-in-law and father-in-law have passed away. And it was not something they ever mentioned to me. And they knew what I did for a living. And so, you know, we started carefully asking questions. I mean, we're not going to put the thumb screws to his elderly aunt, right? You know, you have to, you know, be sensitive in asking questions. If there's one thing I've learned from doing this work over the years, is you can't just barge in like a rhinoceros on the rampage. I mean, you have to be very careful, because bound up with people's memories of wartime is often quite a lot of trauma. But from Zia Maria, we learned that the local parish priest in San Zanone had come to her parents and asked if they would offer shelter to a family that had to go into hiding. Mm-hmm. And they said yes. And so that family stayed with them for a while. And then she can remember at least two more families coming to stay. And they would stay for a while, and then they would move on to another place. Just it was safer to kind of stay on the move to a certain degree. And so with the information we got from her, which is pretty patchy, it was a long time ago, and she was young when it happened, and really only herself had partial information. Mm-hmm. I started doing a bit of digging, and I discovered that the local parish priest, his name was Father Odo Stocco, and he was recognized by Yad Vashem in 2010 for his valor in saving more than 50 Italian Jews from deportation and what would certainly have been death in the death camps in Poland. And so that was fascinating. It was incredible to learn that. It wasn't enough for me. I've not been able to reconstruct all the details. The names, so many names are lost. Most of the people involved have passed away. I'll never be able to come at it as if I were writing a work of historical, you know, nonfiction. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't leave the idea alone. It just stayed with me. And the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to write a book from the perspective of one of the people who had to go into hiding, because mm-hmm. it just tore at my heart. The idea that this imaginary person who developed into my heroine, but that she would have grown up as an Italian. That's how she regarded herself. That was mm-hmm. her culture. her entire upbringing, she was Italian, as well as being Jewish. But suddenly she's told that because she's Jewish, she's not welcome. She's not wanted. She's alien. And she has to go into hiding. And what must that feel like? And what would she have to do to survive? Bearing in mind that the people who are pursuing her are powerful and relentless. Mm-hmm. And so that's the story of that was in the back of it. Was my family story that inspired me. The story itself of Antonina, my heroine, and what happens to her during the war is fiction, but it's grounded in truth. And that's where all my books reside. It's in that intersection between the inspiration of real events, and then I layer on fiction on top of that. So I'm not taking away from anybody else's story. I'm not appropriating the story of, say, one of the people who found shelter with my husband's grandparents. I'm creating a new story, but I'm inspired by the truth. And that's where I feel most comfortable when I'm writing historical fiction. And every writer has a different approach, and no approach is better than the other. That's just the approach that I employ.
I love this. Yeah, I feel like it was like unique enough for the reader to take on, you know, it's a World War II, but it's a unique story set in Italy, like as opposed to, you know, France and all those different places. And it was a unique, like the whole idea of posing as a Christian wife, you mm-hmm. know, just to be hiding.
And that's really what people did. I mean, there's countless stories of how people went into hiding. They were sheltered by their Gentile neighbors. They you know, were forced in public to pretend that they were Christian. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, and that's certainly the case in my book, in Antonina's case, there was absolutely no pressure whatsoever. You know, there was no question that she would ever convert or become something other than what she was. And so she begins the book as a Jewish woman, and she ends the book as a Jewish woman. That was very important to me, that her true self, her true identity be preserved. Mm-hmm. But it was something that a lot of people did. Now, and in some cases, unfortunately, regrettably, people were pressured into conversion, and that's been the story of the Jewish people for thousands of years of constant pressure. And I really did not want that to even be an element in this book. I wanted it to be clear that Antonina, the people closest to her who shelter her, respect her for the person she is. And certainly the evidence shows that Father Stocco did not pressure people to convert. He sheltered them because they were fellow human beings.
Yes, I think that's the beauty of it. You know?
Yeah. And it's just, you know, I am, you know, very moved by the valor, the selflessness of people like Father Stocco and the people in San Zanone, among them my husband's grandparents, who really risked everything to shelter people who were effectively strangers. They were strangers in the beginning, not by the time that they left, but initially they were strangers. That I found very moving, but I found the story that was most compelling for me as a storyteller was the story of the people who had to go into hiding, because they were the people with everything to lose, they were the people who were in the danger was just so deep. It just surrounded them. You would breathe it in with the air, if that makes any sense. And just how did people manage to survive? Because the in Italy, there were just something approaching 40,000 Italian Jews at the beginning of the war. Mm-hmm. And most of them survived, which is very much not the case with places mm-hmm. like Poland or Germany or France. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a complicated story of what happened to Italy's Jews during the war. It's complicated. It's not straightforward. I think maybe that's one of the reasons it hasn't been the focus of much fiction over the years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, more and more people are turning to Italy for the stories they tell. Mm-hmm. And certainly my book is only one of a number of books that are coming out over the next year or so that have Italy as the setting. Italy in World War II is the setting for their stories. So I feel fortunate. I'm kind of at the beginning of of the wave, but there are more stories to come for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I just like, I realized I read World War II somewhat infrequently because it's like that I study it. That's what was my, when I went to college, I was like, my area of focus was World War II. And so it's interesting. Like, I was like, I realized, I was like, you're probably like one of the few Italy books that I read. Like,
there are more on the way. Like, you know, there, I can think of several. And you know, I think it's also the case that you know, other theaters of the war are being mined fairly, you know, thoroughly for stories, mm-hmm. and but readers are still interested in hearing stories of World War II. I mean, there's no sense that World War II is going to be and become an old or tired subject anytime soon. So of course we're looking farther and farther afield and to areas that deserve more attention. I mean, I would love to read about what was going on in North Africa during the war, mm-hmm. what was happening in Asia. There are relatively few stories published in English in North America talking about what happened in the Second World War in Asia, for example. And you know, each month we see the focus kind of widening and moving away from, you know, the more typical stories that are focused in Britain. I mean, one of my previous books, Good Night from London, is set during World War II and it takes place in almost entirely in Britain. And of course, France and Germany and Poland, but and there will continue to be stories published and appreciated about the war and what happened in those countries. But it is nice to see the focus widening because, you know, they're just, this war is, I mean, for something that was so terrible, mm-hmm. and has had such long reaching and long lasting repercussions on the world. At the same time, there are some very, I guess, beautiful stories coming out of this war. Mm-hmm. Beautiful in the sense that we see humankind, you know, in its finest moments, even as it's battling humankind in its darkest moments. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that contrast that makes people so interested, how people can still retain their essential humanity, their essential goodness, even when faced against unutterable evil. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, what fascinates so many of us.
Yeah, I love this. So what are you working next?
So I've moved away from, I've taken a little break from World War II. And in fact, I've moved forward in time just a little bit. I won't be writing contemporary fiction anytime soon. but my next book is called Coronation Year. My next book after Our Darkest Night, I should add. It's called Coronation Year. It's set in 1953. And it's set in a small hotel, one of those little hotels that, you know, it's not part of a chain of any description. It's just a little quirky hotel where the kind of place that you discover by accident and then you end up going back to stay there again and again. And it's about the people who live in the hotel and the effect that how should I put it? The hotel is very unexpectedly on the route for the coronation procession when the queen, still the queen, but when the young Queen Elizabeth II is crowned on the 2nd of June, 1953. And of course, London is absolutely wall to wall with people who want a view of the coronation procession. Mm-hmm. And this little hotel, is in the front row, as it were. So there's that part of it. And then there's also a bit of an element of suspense, because there are some people who want to disrupt the proceedings and possibly even mount an attack on the coronation procession. And the characters in my book are really the only people who can stop it. So that's what I'm working on now. And I hand the manuscript in the summer, and it will be coming to readers, I think, in the middle of, let's say, 2022, which mm-hmm. seems so far away, but really is only about a year and a half, mm-hmm. possibly a bit farther away. We'll see how quickly I can write over this, what's going to be a very long and cold winter.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. I love that you're taking us to different time periods. And it's like, and you had the gown, which is like.
Yeah. I'm moving forward incrementally. And I think 1953, to be honest, is about the latest I want to go. Okay. And then I'll probably cycle back to the turn of the century, or say World War One again.
Feels amazing. It's a good time, by the way.
Well, and the thing is, I say, oh, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. Really, I don't know. I have coronation year lined up, and I have a few other vague ideas. But quite often, the best ideas for my books are the ones that take me kind of by surprise, mm-hmm. Such as the idea for Our Darkest Night, or even the idea for the gown, which kind of came out of nowhere and was really just my wanting to know what happened, what life was like in Britain after the war. Mm-hmm. But then trying to find a way to tell the story that wasn't completely depressing. And I found it, of course, because, royal weddings are just innately cheerful things. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of the point where the fun of the royal wedding met the gloom of post-war life. That's where I found my story.
I love this. I love that you're finding intersections of an inspiration at the same time, something that brings you joy and something that does have some gloom around it, but it's like there's joyful moments.
Yeah. Well, nobody wants a book where the entire book is soaked in like what feels like maple syrup, right? Since I'm Canadian, I'll use that analogy. But nobody wants a book at the same time that's just so gloomy and miserable that it's just an effort to get through. Certainly now. I mean, I've been turning to books that feel hopeful. And that's what I want people to take away from Our Darkest Night, mm-hmm. is that there are tough moments in the book. Anything written about the Holocaust or World War II there's going to be tough moments, but it is ultimately a story of hope. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I want to read right now. And I'm hoping that others agree.
Yes, I love this. So now let's go to writer book recommendations. This is an opportunity for you to share with the audience what they should read next.
I was going to say, so we were talking earlier about other books set in Italy. And fair warning that the author is a friend of mine. And I have what we say blurbed the book, mm-hmm. Offered my recommendation for it. The book is called Courage, My Love. It's by Kristen Beck, B-E-C-K. It comes out in April of 2021, mm-hmm. and it is set in Italy during World War II, but it is set in Rome, so more or less at the opposite end of the country from where Our Darkest Night is set. Very different story, wonderful story. And I'll tell you, I was so drawn in by the story that when I finished it, I emailed Kristen and said, I told her how much I loved it, but I also said, do you have Italian family members? Is your background Italian? Because I could swear that you grew up in an Italian family or part of an Italian family. Just because the way that she depicts Italian women, mm-hmm. is so beautiful, so heartfelt, so loving. It is not that, these are not stereotypical, Italian nonnas. These are really rounded, fascinating, complicated characters. And they were so true to life. And it turns out she has lived in Italy, but she's not part of an Italian family. This is just a testament to her abilities as a writer. I was very, very impressed by this book. And it stuck with me for a long time after I finished reading it. So I really recommend it. So Courage, My Love by Kristen Beck, coming out in April.
I love this. Thank you, Jennifer.
You're welcome.
Tell us where we can find you online.
So my website, which I'm trying to update, and I'm getting there, is jennifer-robson.com. You can also find me on Instagram and Facebook at author Jennifer Robson, all squished together. And you know, I love going on Instagram because I love sharing, you know, pictures drawn from my research, mm-hmm. Some of my cooking projects, not always successful. There's lots of dog and cat pictures as well. My animals do love to pose for pictures. Mm-hmm. And you know, when I travel, there are pictures. There won't be travel pictures for a while, but you know, I do plan on sharing more pictures from my visits to Italy so that people can see the places and the people that inspired our darkest night.
I love this. Thank you, Jennifer, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share with friends, subscribe, rate, and review the show. This is the easiest way to support this podcast. Once you connect with fellow romance readers and make new friends, get weekly book recommendations, attend monthly meetups, then join our Patreon community. You can join at whatyourextblog.com/Patreon. Romance lovers, check out Queen Bee Reads Etsy shop for cute and comfortable bookish apparel. The shop also features social justice apparel and fun items from some of your favorite TV shows like The Schitt's Creek and The Office. Use code WHATTORE10 to save. Visit whatyourextblog.com/QueenBeeReads. What's Your Next Podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Discover new podcasts to love on frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What's Your Next Podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyourextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.